Welcome to Nerds at Church, a podcast diving deep into nerdery and the Bible. I'm Pastor Emily, and I use pronouns like they, them, theirs.
And I'm Pastor Kay, and my pronouns are she, her. In this episode, we'll discuss All Saints Day, which this year falls on November 1st, and every year.
But you might be
commemorating it on a different day.
Yes. You might be commemorating it on November 5th this year.
Yes.
But we're doing a different thing to remember the 5th of November this year. Also, don't forget to check out our survey. Make sure you fill out our listener survey. We really want your feedback. It would be awesome and super helpful for us as we plan for season 4 and all of those changes that will come. It is linked in the episode description and also bit.ly/NAC listener survey. Check out the episode description for links to the Bible passages and other references we make in this episode. We do have a couple content notifications for this episode. We talk about Christian supremacy and miscarriage in the deep dive, and miscarriage also in the gospel.
So for our deep dive today, we thought we would talk about funerals.
Right, funerals. We've already done weddings, and since, you know, we've got a movie commentary for our Patreon supporters on 4 weddings and a funeral, we figured funerals were a good topic to cover, too.
Yeah, especially since we did death with a death doula last year for All Saints, and the year before that we talked about saints in general.
Yeah, so, and this way, All Saints Day is a day where a lot of us are really focusing on people that we love that have died. So we thought this would be a good way to talk about it.
Yeah.
So we're going to start off and do some quick touches. So a disclaimer, neither Kay nor I are Jewish or Muslim or atheist.
Right.
And all of those communities also deserve good funerals. So we have some basics, but as always, check with the actual people for whatever practices they need if you are going to be attending a funeral or if you know someone who might be somewhere in that process. So one of the things that I love to point out is that different cultures and different faiths have different sayings that go along with death. So for Jewish people, when someone dies, they say, "May their memory be for a blessing," which is lovely and beautiful and a very important thing to do when someone is Jewish and has died.
Yes.
For Muslims, they frequently say, "To God we belong and to God we shall return," or "May peace be upon them," are both really good options for something to say. And many Christians say, "Rest in peace." Some, especially organizers, say, "Rest in power." There are all sorts of different options. The most important part is don't use a Christian term for someone who's not Christian.
Yeah.
Unless you know that that is something that they resonate with. This is especially true for, like, most obviously true for Jewish people, who the ways that Christians have tried to convert Jewish people and have tried to erase them, it is really important to use the language that they use about themselves and not our own Christian language to talk about it, just as a disclaimer. And also, who doesn't want to say, "May their memory be for a blessing"? Actually, on this podcast, we had a rabbi say that about Twitter.
Yes.
Which is a whole other thing. So that is one of the, like, initial things. When a Jewish person hears about a death, they can also recite the words Baruch Dayan Emet, which is "Blessed be the one true judge." So that's another option there.
Yeah. So for a Jewish funeral, ideally the service will happen within one day following the date of death, which follows a tradition called Kavod Hemet, which is honoring the dead. And traditionally speaking, a Jewish casket will be a simple pine box, and there will be no cremation or embalming. The idea is that the person is buried in the same way that they lived, essentially, as far as I'm aware. And there is a sacred burial society called the Shevra Kadisha, which gathers to prepare the body and will dress the body in a white burial shroud. A Jewish funeral service is solemn and reflective, and one of the better known Jewish grieving traditions that we've mentioned before on this podcast is to tear a garment, or sometimes to tear a ribbon that is part of a pin that one wears, in order to symbolize the grief and allow the people around you to know that you're grieving.
And sometimes the rabbi will do that, and sometimes people will do that themselves. Yeah. And then for the funeral itself, for the ceremony, usually psalms are read or chanted. There's a eulogy, so someone will speak about the person's life. The rabbi or whoever's leading the service will say the memorial prayer. And then as they head to the burial, the body leaves first, and then the closest mourners, and then everybody kind of follows. If people are not going all the way to be part of the burial, they might walk with the casket, behind the casket for a little bit to get it to the cemetery, but without the whole process and staying for, if they can't stay for the whole thing. At the cemetery, there is a tradition of stopping 7 times with the casket, the body, to recite Psalm 91, and then lower the casket, and there's a tradition around adding a few handfuls of dirt on top of the casket for the burial.
After the service, the folks who can will go back to the home of the chief mourners, essentially the closest family members or the closest friends, whoever the folks closest to the deceased were. They will go to that home and sit Shiva together. Shiva traditionally lasts 7 days following the funeral, although on occasion it winds up being shorter because there are certain holy days that stop that, and you can't sit Shiva on those days. And during that time, mirrors in the home will be covered. You don't want to bring flowers to someone who's sitting Shiva, but you, by all means, bring food.
Definitely bring food.
And when you are sitting with them, follow the lead of whoever those chief mourners are. If they want to tell funny stories, then tell funny stories. If they are sad and they just want to be quiet, that's fine too, and let them do that. They get to set the tone.
And that's generally just a good practice.
Yeah, absolutely.
No matter what tradition it is.
Comfort in, discomfort out is the old rule for grieving. You want to send comfort in towards the center of the circle, towards the people closest to the deceased, and any discomfort that you have with the process goes outwards, further away from the loved ones of the deceased.
That kind of concentric circles of care is something that we talk about in a variety of different contexts as well. And it is just helpful to follow somebody's lead in how they're mourning. But also, one of the things that I was told as a chaplain that I think was really helpful in following this is that, like, emotion is okay and is natural and can be a good response or reaction to something. And if you show more emotion than the person who is closest to the grief, they will end up trying to comfort you. And that's not what you want. So it's okay to cry. It is not okay to sob and wail when they are crying quietly.
Yeah.
And now, as we move into Muslim funerals, we've already mentioned that one of the things that you can say in response to hearing that someone who's Muslim has died is, "To God we belong, and to God we shall return," or "May peace be upon them."
Again, with a Muslim funeral service, the burial will take place as quickly as possible after the death. The body is washed and covered with a sheet by the family, and the deceased's hands are placed as though they are praying. And the body will be taken to the location for the funeral, which is often a mosque prayer room or a courtyard or something like that. There is rarely an open casket for a Muslim funeral. Usually the casket is closed. And the body itself and also all attendees of the service will face Mecca.
For the funeral service itself, it is a very spiritual service. It is intended to help cope with grief and also to provide hope for a good afterlife for the person who has died. The imam will lead funeral prayers and for the service, and then after the body goes to the burial site, people will form a silent procession behind it. Traditionally, it has been just men for funerals, and that is especially still the case for the burials, although Depending on the community, there might be more diversity in that. And there is a tradition for each person at the burial to throw 3 handfuls of dirt on the grave after the casket is lowered down. Similar to Judaism, there's no cremation and no embalming if possible. There are some places where it is legally required, which is weird because it's not great for the environment. They also, like, there's a discouraging of autopsies even because of the belief in the bodily resurrection. Flowers are acceptable in Islam, so flowers can be sent to the family's home after burial, and in the 40-day mourning period following the death, flowers and food are much appreciated for them.
If you are attending a Muslim funeral, remember that loud wailing is not expected or really welcome at those services, but crying is certainly okay and quite normal. Also, generally speaking, you don't want to take pictures or make any recordings. The service is often so personal that they don't want records. Or if they do want records, they've arranged for it themselves. So don't take it upon yourself to do that for them.
Also, in general, they just are less.
Yeah. Less fond of the
other.
And then when you gather at the family's home afterwards, certainly express condolences and try to stay the whole day or usually at least for a meal. There is usually one.
One thing that I just want to point out that is unique because of how things have come about in Christianity, embalming and cremation are much more common within Christian traditions than Judaism or Islam and a variety of other traditions. Environmentally speaking, it is best not to embalm and not to cremate. So there's a traditionality of it that, like, back when you couldn't preserve a body, you got to get it in the ground as fast as possible.
Right.
And there is also wisdom and environmental care and concern involved in that.
Right.
And then we also wanted to talk a little bit about services, particularly for folks who are not necessarily Christian, who are secular, agnostic, atheist, or maybe some people are in the family and some people aren't. There's all sorts of complexities that we live with nowadays with the variety of faith experiences and religious traditions that people are a part of. So a couple really important things that are specific to this, but also you can generalize to other traditions, funerals. Don't change the person's religion after they die. If they were atheist or agnostic, don't pretend like they were Christian.
Yeah.
Bad idea. Some of this stuff feels like really obvious, and yet there's a reason why we're telling you these things. Also, especially if they were trans, don't dead name them in death. Don't misgender them.
Right.
If you are not sure if you can use the right name and the right pronouns for them, then you should not be talking, or you should be practicing a lot beforehand.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of pastoral, like, navigation in that that can happen, but it is really, really important to not misgender and dead name trans people in particular after they die.
Yeah.
Too many people do that. It erases us. It is violent much of the time after violence has already happened.
Yeah. If the deceased was pagan, and I'm particularly thinking in cases where the deceased was pagan and the rest of their family isn't and might have, you know, opinions about that kind of thing. I asked around a few years ago about this, and in that case, what you want to do is find whatever worship-related or pagan-related gear that they have, gather that together, and if you know what their pagan community was in their area, return all of that gear to that local community. If you don't know what their community was, then look online for a local pagan community. And even if it's not the right group, they will be grateful to make sure that the necessary things happen to those things. The thing is, often what will happen is that families will either throw this stuff away, which is not respectful to the dead person's religion, or in some cases, actually, folks will try to bury some of that stuff with the person. And depending on the pagan tradition, there are some things that are specifically supposed to stay with the living. And to my knowledge, there isn't really stuff that is supposed to be buried with the person. There are just some things that really aren't. And so when in doubt, keep that stuff with a local community. And if you give it to the wrong community, they'll just be glad that you're trying to be respectful and they will try to figure that out for you. But at least it won't get thrown away that way.
Or with you.
Yeah.
Also, for funerals, much like for weddings, there are a couple things that need to happen, but actually nothing has to be a particular way.
Yeah.
You don't have to have prayer if prayer is not meaningful. And if you do want prayer, it doesn't have to be Jesus-y. There are a lot of varieties of beautiful poems, of more non-Christian prayers, those sorts of things that can be really meaningful during a funeral.
Yeah.
Also, the readings, again, like weddings, the readings don't have to be just from the Bible. You can have readings that are poems, that are excerpts from stories. You potentially, if the person like somehow knew they were going to die, had a terminal illness or something, they might have written a letter to their community.
Yeah.
I would read it first before just automatically saying yes to it being in a funeral.
You never know.
But yeah. Those can be really meaningful and beautiful things. Also, the songs don't have to be from the hymnal or from 50 years ago's hymnal, as the case may be, or 150 years ago. Yep. I know people who did 500 Miles by Peter, Paul, and Mary, By My Side from Godspell. There are so many different options that can really resonate. And we'll talk about this a little bit more later in the more explicitly Christian part, but it also goes for any funeral that you are participating. Also, a lot of folks have some sort of memento. Prayer cards are pretty common within Christian traditions. I've gotten them for my family members. I know someone who did a bookmark with places to do a book list, and they had the person's life like as the check-in, and there's like a check-in and then different things with different dates, like a one of those library things.
Nice.
And then had a like checked out date. It was adorable. And it was very reflective of who the person had been in her life to do that as her thing instead of like a prayer card.
Sure. Now, one of the go-to moves for a funeral where there is not a particular religious tradition being addressed is having some open mic time. And in some times and places, that can be wonderful and lovely and very welcoming to the folks who are able to be there. On the other hand, you might also want to keep in mind, what kind of person was the deceased, and did they, say, tend to piss off a lot of people? Or are they the type of person who, there might be folks who are there just to make sure that they're actually dead. An open mic time is not a universal good option. There are some situations where it's not a good choice. You might not want to go there. Think about that in advance before you decide to have one.
Agreed. Speaking of, if you are planning to use clergy, and you, particularly Christian clergy, and you don't want it to be a Christian service, vet the clergy, particularly so that they don't attribute religion to the person who died, but also so that they are respectful of your needs, the people who are closest to the person who died's needs, the wishes of the person who died, all of that stuff.
Yeah, and I would add a note that most clergy are very capable of, say, acknowledging the fact that the deceased was religious, but the family members who are attending the service are not. Or vice versa, that the family members who are attending are religious and the person who has died was not. Like, there are ways to acknowledge both of those things in a respectful and honest way. And so we can say Christian prayers with Christians, maybe before or after the service, you know, that kind of thing, to acknowledge that the person who died wasn't religious. Or we can say prayers on behalf of the deceased, even though some of those present might not really believe in them, but as a way of honoring the deceased. There's a middle ground for a lot of this stuff. But basically, what you want to make sure that there is space for in any of these services is that people have space to grieve and also to comfort and be comforted. That there is an acknowledgement of imperfection. No person is perfect, nor should we be expected to be. And while in the immediate aftermath of death, we often try to make the person sound perfect, really, we know better. Certainly a gratitude for the person's life, I hope. And also, you do, if at all possible, want to try to add some kind of hope in the midst of this loss. A note of hope can really help everyone present move on to the next day.
Yeah. Lying or hiding the truth is generally not helpful in grieving. It might not be comfortable, but it's much more helpful in the grieving process to not be gaslit about harm that has happened. So, yeah. One of the other places that kind of gets its own unique space is the death of infants, and especially any miscarriages or stillbirths. that might happen, those are real losses, and those deserve the space for grief. Depending on the situation, how far along the pregnancy was, you might not be able to do a full funeral service. A lot of hospitals have a memorial service every year that they invite people to who have had miscarriages or stillbirths. I know as a chaplain, I did a lot of blessings of babies. I did some naming rites. So while in our tradition and in most Christian traditions, you do not baptize dead
people,
yeah, including those who have not actually been born,
yeah,
we can do a naming rite. We can create that space to name and acknowledge the life that was being nurtured and the hopes for that life, while also holding that space for the grief at its loss. So if you are in that situation, and most hospital chaplains, aside from that potentially Catholic hospitals, most chaplains are supposed to be there for spiritual and emotional care for patients and their loved ones. So if you're going through something, ask if there's a chaplain there. You never know.
Yeah.
And I think pregnancy, labor, and delivery usually doesn't know as much about the chaplains and makes some assumptions about chaplains only come for terrible things. But they can come for good things too, or for just, I'm a little anxious.
Yeah, absolutely. I would also throw out there that chaplains, much like therapists or doctors, love getting those calls, the happy calls, and the I'm just kind of in a weird in-between place and don't really know how I should feel calls, because otherwise their day is just one tragedy after another, and that's exhausting. So, like, they want to hear from you when it is something else.
And now, for Christians, we say things like, rest in peace and rest in power. Rest in Power has a particular tradition among those who are protesters and organizers for justice. Rest in Peace is pretty common across Christianity.
Yeah. And Emily and I do not really claim to be experts on Christianity in general. We do claim to be experts on our branch of Lutheranism in particular. And so acknowledging that all denominations are different and have different practices around funerals, and we do not have time to go through the, say, you know, dozen most populous denominations in the U.S. for funerals. Instead, let's talk about what can you expect and most likely not expect at an ELCA funeral, which is what we do know.
And with the caveat that it is fairly similar across Protestant denominations.
Well, yeah, the general feel you're going for is often very similar, but like the what's included in the service may be a little different. Our ELCA service is very similar to an Episcopalian service and is actually hilariously similar to a Catholic service because Martin Luther took a lot of stuff with him on his way out the door. But one of the unusual things about our funeral service in particular is that while we do have a lot of folks who like to make their own liturgy for regular Sunday worship services and like to be inventive and do new things, the standard rule for new pastors in the ELCA is do your first couple funerals by the book. Don't try to mess with it yet. Just do the first few. And then once you've done like three of them or so, then you'll know what really feels right or what really feels weird to you. But the thing is that the liturgy that is provided in our books tends to be very comforting and deeply meaningful to most folks. I cannot tell you the vast number of people who have walked out of one of my funerals and been so earth-shakingly grateful for what the funeral was, and what they're talking about had nothing to do with me. It was all just directly out of the book. And that's because our liturgy is designed to be comforting and meaningful and not any of the horror stories that you have heard from folks, because let me tell you, I've heard those too. We try very hard to provide a welcoming and loving experience, and also acknowledge that there's a lot of folks out there who don't. I don't know how else to say this, but I have occasionally met ELCA pastors who will, like, emotionally manipulate grieving people and who will do not great stuff. But as long as they go by the book during the service, they can't really get that far off the baseline
except
of
for in the
behavior.
Yeah. And even with our liturgy, it can be adapted fairly easily to fit interreligious families or communities or people who have just kind of like a mix of different traditions or preferences. One of the things that I really like is that communion is an option. Mm-hmm. And also, if you are thinking about having communion as an option, think about who else will come. If the majority of this person's friends and family were Jewish, maybe communion is not actually a great plan. Yeah. And that's okay.
Or atheist, for that matter.
Yeah, yeah.
When you come to an ELCA funeral, you will almost certainly not experience an altar call. In fact, I have met a remarkable number of Lutherans who don't know what an altar call is. So that's not really something to expect. And almost certainly you will not experience a list of people who are going to hell, which is something I have experienced in Lutheran churches, just not an ELCA church. I did once have a woman who occasionally does funerals, although she's not actually a pastor, tell me that funerals are a great time to tell people to get right with Jesus, and I did not set her on fire, and I consider that a professional accomplishment of mine. So,
good job. Yeah. Good job. Murder bad.
Yeah. But honestly, most funerals, you won't have to worry about that.
There are some Christian traditions that do have, and some Lutheran churches that I've heard of, that do have altar calls. They usually come from traditions where they have altar calls more regularly anyway. Yeah. And so that can be a different thing. Also, there is a beauty in, like, and a possibility of an altar call, that is, if you need just a little bit of extra prayer, that can really
Yeah, that's not really exactly the kind of thing I was thinking about. But yes, a healing
I know,
prayer sort of thing can be lovely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, a funeral is focused on the person who's died and on God's love for us. So when you are thinking about it, like, there is a focus on the person, but also it is a worship service. So there's a focus on God's love. And that's been one of the, I think, best ways that I've witnessed and experienced and done of acknowledging maybe someone who is atheist or the family is atheist or something, but to acknowledge the abundance of God's love as part of also acknowledging the person who may or may not be Christian.
Right. And again, I can only speak for the ELCA funeral service, but I have found that it often helps people to turn a corner or take the next step in the grieving process. Often folks will come to the funeral sort of stuck in a state of shock, and the funeral helps them to express what they're feeling to a certain extent, and then helps them to get to the next step of, okay, now what happens? And that can be very useful for folks. I've had more than one family express that they weren't expecting that to happen, but it was super helpful.
Yeah, I think that's, like, honestly, it's hard to mess up a funeral, particularly if you're following the liturgy that we have in the ELCA.
Like, I'm not saying it's impossible. Yeah.
No, but you have to work to do it. Yeah. And that is the place where, like, sometimes we've talked in clergy circles about, like, funerals can be really good for communities.
Yeah.
Not that, like, you want someone to die, but when a community hasn't had a funeral for a long time, when they finally do, it can be a reminder of the care and the love that they have for each other and the connections that they have and the
and why they value having
the community of faith that they are. And then in a funeral, we do commendations. So Lutherans do not pray for the dead. They are, in our understanding, already with God and don't need our prayers anymore. They're good. They're taken care of. Certainly we give thanks for their life and for the witness that they have been for who God is and how God is at work in the world. But we do, so we give thanks for that, but we don't pray for them specifically. We do, however, commend them to God or hand them over to God's keep. And this is one of the pieces of the service that I think people underestimate how impactful it is. It is a big part in that getting to the next step is to be, have like some version of, here you go, God, this person who I treasure, I am handing over to you.
Yeah.
And that usually happens during the funeral service, depending on, now it's shifted a lot with the pandemic that there's a lot more distance between funeral and burial or death and funeral, burial, memorial service stuff because all of a sudden people couldn't be there. And then it created the space for people to wait and plan a time when more people could come instead of having the usual, like, within 3 days, we're going to do this thing.
Yeah.
And you just have to magically get across the country for
or
it.
Or miss it forever.
Have fun.
Yeah, I recently did a funeral that was a month after the death because the person's granddaughter had just given birth and she and the baby wanted to be there. And so they waited a month so that the baby would be able to be out in public. And it was great.
Yeah.
So another aspect of funerals that we don't acknowledge nearly often enough is that a lot of us who are Christian will at some point or another wind up working with a clergy person we don't know to plan a funeral. And that can be kind of awkward. Don't worry, the clergy know it's awkward too. We've done this before.
Yep.
And these days, most churches have at least some of their previous services online. And so if there's one useful piece of advice I can offer you, if you can't look at one of their previous funerals, because those may or may not be online, you can at least look probably at a regular worship service. And I would especially suggest looking at a sermon by the preacher who is handling the funeral and the prayers for that service to kind of get a feel for what do they think is normal. Because remember, their normal is not your normal. And if you have a loved one who you know that you will play a major part in their funeral planning and arrangements, and they are getting close to the end of things, feel free to check this out before they die. Like, I don't want to encourage you to have superstitious thoughts about, well, if I look at their pastor to see what they are like before this person dies, then I'm asking for them to die. No, you're not. You're taking an interest and a sense of care in your loved one. And in fact, you can talk to them about what do they value in their worship community and what do they value about whoever the current clergy folks are and all that kind of thing. And it can be a great conversation to have.
It's true. And if you don't know who you want, if you don't have a clergy person in mind, if you haven't been really connected with a congregation or that sort of a thing, a lot of the time funeral homes will know of clergy who are willing to be contacted. That you just kind of run into if the funeral home people acknowledge women or queer people as being valid pastors. So there's a little of navigation in that. But also, I know for me, I like doing funerals does provide extra income. So I tend to be very willing to do weddings and funerals for folks and to talk with them and work with them because I also believe in caring for people in that way and making sure that they have the support that they need, which is why we say that most clergy are open to making the family feel welcome. Most clergy you will be working with want you to feel welcome and want you to receive care.
Yeah.
So feel free to ask questions and make requests. Keep in mind the timeline, right? There's probably a deadline to make choices for the service, both in terms of logistics, in terms of printing things, in terms of having time to write a sermon or a homily. And there might be rules about what is or is not allowed, what they can or cannot do. So it's also important, especially if you're using the space of the congregation, which is the building, to respect those guidelines and to respect the space that you are in.
Yeah. Speaking of respecting the space, some of the rules that this place may have, particularly the ones about the worship space, such as like, yes, you may place flowers here. No, you may not place flowers there. Particularly the rules they seem a little extra enthusiastic about. Usually those rules are written in blood, which is to say they have stories behind them about why they exist. And also, the folks at that place may not actually be interested in telling you those stories, depending on what exactly they come from. Like, there might also be a bunch of emotions attached to those stories. So you might not get to hear them. But if this is not your regular worship space, you probably don't actually need to hear what the stories are behind those rules. You just need to understand the rules and be respectful to the space and those people, because you are a guest. A welcome guest, but still a guest.
Yep, exactly. And if there is food that's going to happen after the service, trust the folks in charge of the food. If you're doing your own food, that's one thing. If the congregation is providing food for the meal, they probably know what they're doing. They might not know anything about dietary restrictions. You might have to say something if you're a vegetarian, speaking entirely from experience. Mm-hmm. But feel free to ask their advice. They might know the area in the building better than you do. In general, for food and whatever else, feel free to ask for input or advice. It's really helpful. And Kay kind of hinted at this. Planning ahead for a funeral is actually a great act of love.
Yes.
For yourself and for your community. There are some congregations, and we don't say this often, but if your congregation hasn't, maybe ask your pastor to do this.
Yeah.
It is amazing how helpful this can be for congregations and communities to have these records.
And like a workshop on planning for your funeral.
Yeah. You could do it for Lent. If you ask now, it's perfect timing to plan it for Lent. I'm just saying. But do the planning ahead, right? There are certain songs that I know are really important to me for a funeral. There are Bible passages that are really important, those sorts of things. I know I want a green burial. I know I like colorfulness and I don't want people to just all wear black. And there are other end of life decisions that are really helpful that we talked about some with Justin last year for All Saints Day. But having those meaningful conversations can be really helpful. Even if you don't do it in a congregation, doing it with your family, however you define family, is really helpful because it helps them know if something happens. It gives them the preparation to know what you would want if you are not able to say it yourself. And there is no way to articulate how helpful that is when people are in the midst of trauma.
Yeah.
Having something that says, these are the things, so helpful. And that includes things like your favorite hymns, your favorite Bible stories or passages, that sort of stuff.
Sure. Also, funerals are really meant for the living, for the people who attend them. And so this is a good time to ask yourself, what will your loved ones need to hear? You know, your sister may need to focus on God's all-encompassing love, and your brother may need to focus more on a reminder that you will all be together again, that kind of thing. Everybody will have their own needs at that point, and being able to offer the clergy person in question a hint about that can be super helpful. Also, if there is one hint that I can offer folks who are trying to plan this sort of thing that maybe you wouldn't expect, it's that some guidance for your loved ones on what kind of casket or urn you would like can be incredibly helpful, because this tends to be the one thing no one remembered to think about in advance. I cannot tell you the That's number true. Of folks who get to this part of the funeral planning meeting and it just have absolutely no concept of where they're going. And so
pine box.
Sure.
Pine wood box.
So like, do you want dark wood versus light wood versus metal versus, I once saw a really lovely soapstone urn. There are lots of different options. And so any kind of guidance you can offer can be helpful. The other useful piece of information, if you're trying to figure this out for someone else and they've already died, I once heard someone talk about, look at their kitchen table and see if that can offer you any guidance. Because often the kitchen table is one of the places that they have spent their most time at and may have the most memories for you and their loved ones. And so if the casket or urn can remind people of the kitchen table, even if it's just the same color, that can be really helpful.
That's really beautiful.
Yeah, I don't remember where I picked that up, but somebody mentioned it to me once and I thought it was a really nice way to think about it.
Yeah. I'm here for it.
Yeah. Also, sometimes those are handed down, and if not, the person probably picked it out themselves. So, and then acknowledging how and what you want to be remembered for can be very helpful to the folks who are figuring out the service, as well as any topics that might be off limits. Yes, I am fine with you guys talking about my habits of hilarious Halloween costumes. No, you are not talking about my stepbrother, that kind of thing. Giving those guidelines, again, can be very helpful to making sure that your death is acknowledged the way you had hoped. I would also throw out there that some folks like to try to tell their families to not have a funeral. That's not entirely your call. Like, you could certainly say, no, don't have a Christian funeral for me. No, don't go with that particular clergy person. But how your loved ones want to grieve you is not actually a decision that you get to be involved in.
Yeah. My aunt, so I was very involved in kind of talking through her end of life stuff when she went into hospice, because it was literally my job at the time. And she said she didn't necessarily want a memorial service, and she recognized that it may be helpful for her loved ones. And so if so, these would be like important things, which was really helpful because of course my mom wanted one. And like, of course, like we wanted to have something. And so that was really helpful. Also, one of the things that's really helpful if the person has already died and you're working with clergy and it's someone who maybe doesn't know the person as well or even just doesn't know you as well, I always start my first meeting with a family or with loved ones by asking them to tell me stories about their loved one.
Yeah.
It helps me get to know the person more. It helps me to get to know the person through their eyes. And it really helps me be able to craft my sermon and craft some of the like suggestions for parts of the liturgy in a way that fits with the person, the family, and the community of around them.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we just had a handful of tips from experienced clergy, that is to say us, do's and don'ts surrounding funerals. So the first one, and we have also brushed against this before, everybody up front being sober is just as important at a funeral as it is at a wedding. Like actually, funerals and weddings have a lot of things in common. For example, mm-hmm. also, much like a wedding, let this service do its job and don't expect it to also do a whole bunch of other stuff for you, like fixing relationships. That's probably not gonna happen.
What?
Like maybe, but probably not. That is not the funeral's
job. It might exacerbate problems.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Because of the stress of death and all of that.
Also, much like a wedding, please remember to eat real food. Have a frickin' sandwich already, would you? You will be surprised how much easier grieving is when you do it on a full stomach. This is not a time to try a new diet.
Yeah, no. Even if your stomach is unsettled in the morning, try to have like crackers or bread or something in your body.
Yeah.
It will help.
Yeah.
Also, eulogies are not required. There are some clergy who absolutely despise eulogies and some who love them. I generally don't push for eulogies. If somebody wants it, I will like let them, right? But eulogies are not required. And they don't have to be from one person in particular.
No.
A lot of times we think, oh, the oldest child has to give the eulogy, when in fact the adult grandchild might be the best bet because there's just a little bit removed from the grandparent.
I did that for my grandmother.
Speaking as the grandkid that did not get to give a eulogy.
Goodness.
Yeah. If you do plan on doing a eulogy, it is helpful to have the eulogy or the memories be typed out as like the full everything you're gonna say, or if nothing else, like full information bullet points, so that if something happens and you get, as they say, verklempt, the pastor can come to the rescue as necessary, that someone else can take over if need be. Also, always put the sermon after the eulogy, because some people say particular things for the eulogy that can be really harmful and can be really harmful theology. And so that gives the clergy person the chance to kind of clean it up a bit if need be.
Yeah.
And also to be really clear, like we literally went to school for years to be able to like preach a sermon that fits.
Yeah, you don't have to. That's not your job.
Yeah.
To our listeners, not to Emily. That is totally Emily's job.
Yeah.
Also, okay, again, I can't speak for other traditions, but when it comes to Lutheran funeral services, we are kind of renowned for having the world's shortest funerals. If we make it to a solid 30 minutes, including all the music, that means that there was some extra music. So our services are quite short, in part because they're emotional roller coasters. And so, like, if you have a tradition of a funeral service that lasts for like 6 hours, then I am not speaking to you right now. But when it comes to a Lutheran funeral service and frankly, most Midwestern Protestant white people services, I guess, which is what I've mostly experienced, really the funeral is short for a reason. These are emotionally exhausting times and they kind of are on purpose because they're trying to help you get to that next step of your grieving process. And so my suggestion would be that you really don't want more than two people sharing memories or giving eulogies, and each of those people should probably be limited to around 5 minutes or less.
Yeah. I was at a funeral out here, not white, Methodist, it was at a black church, and one of the traditions there is that any clergy that came would introduce themselves and bring greetings on behalf of their congregation. I was coming not as clergy, so I did not do that. I also was not told that that's a thing that happened until sure. after we were like already on the way. But that's like, that can be a helpful thing. And that's a tradition where the service is longer.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. Also, you don't have to use the funeral home for everything or for anything. There are less costly cremation type services. The funeral home does make it easier logistically, and it usually costs more money. So it's one of those, like, what do you have available?
Yeah.
Time? Money? Neither? Both?
Right. However, if you don't go with a funeral home, please ask the place of worship that you're working with, if you are working with one, what kinds of things does the funeral home usually take care of so that the important things don't get skipped over? A lot of places of worship will have yes. those now. Also, and this is more personal advice on my part, if you aren't familiar with the funeral homes in that area and you need to choose one quickly and you don't have a lot to go on in that case, my general rule is go with a funeral home that is more rural, more small town, less major city, because all funeral homes vary. Some funeral homes are great and some are not, and you're rolling the dice every time. But the ones in the smaller communities and the more rural communities have to, frankly, depend on repeat customers. And so they are going to make sure that they take personal care of you and your family in a way that the big city folks don't necessarily feel like they have to, because they're always going to have more customers. I have worked with a lot of different funeral homes, and the one case where the funeral director reminded me of a used car salesman was also the funeral home that was in the biggest city I ever worked in. And like, honestly, to be entirely fair to the guy, he did a perfectly nice job. He was very professional. He just also had a little sleaze attached to him, and that was probably not his fault. I feel bad about saying that now. But if you don't know how to pick, when in doubt, go for the smaller community. And you'll be still rolling the dice, but the odds will be slightly in your favor. Wow, that phrase has a terrible connotation to it now. Okay.
But like, not Hunger right. Games style.
No murder.
Okay. Murder, bad. Yes. Yeah, I was going to say, I've had great experiences, but most of the funerals or memorial services I have done have been in a small town, or it was a family. Like, the one that I did here in Baltimore was a family funeral home that had worked with the congregations multiple times. Sure. And yet, I had a parishioner when I was in Minnesota who used to run the funeral home in town, and very much it was his ministry.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a ministry to the community. And so that's a really beautiful thing. Yeah. Also, funeral homes tend to take care of this, but especially if you are not using a funeral home, it is good to pay clergy and musicians and to potentially donate to the congregation if that's where the funeral or memorial service is taking place, if possible. If not, they'll probably understand, but talk to them, talk to the clergy person, and let them know the situation.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be pissed if somebody doesn't pay me, $250 to do their funeral for their loved one.
Cancer is expensive. We get it.
Yeah. But if you're not going to, or if you can't, or anything like that, tell me. Because, like I said before, it is helpful to have the extra money and the extra income. Yeah. And
frankly, also
it's helpful for my budget.
Being able to give the custodian a little extra money for the extra cleaning they had to do, which is probably what that donation we're talking about will go to.
Yep.
And then finally, a rule that is good just in general for all funerals is that we need to remember that people grieve in different ways. And so just because this particular person doesn't happen to be crying in front of you at the particular moment that you were expecting them to cry, that does not mean that they aren't grieving.
Yeah.
There was an article on the different ways that people react to grief and how sometimes folks will want to do really practical stuff and sometimes folks will just completely fall apart and there's no predicting it. Mm-hmm. And I really do want to emphasize that, particularly during the service, like, if someone does fall apart while doing a eulogy or a reading, you will never predict who it's going to be. Because I have seen the most stoic people break down and just lose it, and the most fluttery and emotional people soldier on through getting through whatever their piece was. You don't know. It's not predictable at all.
Yeah. When I was in doing my chaplaincy residency, we talked about that, and we talked about it as instrumental grieving and intuitive grieving. So intuitive grieving is the like deep in your feels
yes.
grieving, and instrumental is let's do the things, like
yeah.
take care of all of the arrangements, all of that stuff. And there's people assume who naturally falls into one or the other, especially by gender.
Sure.
And so there are people who don't fall into the one that would normally be assigned to them. And so there's a disenfranchised grief that happens then because they are expected to react one way and that's not their natural reaction.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and there's more than just those options, right? There's blended
yeah.
and that sort of thing. But it was really helpful to know and to like be able to recognize sometimes when there was a grieving family and one person was just like sitting there deep in their emotions and somebody else was like, do you have a readout of the last heartbeat? Like, or his heartbeat or those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And it's like, I recognize that this is grief, even if others in your circle won't.
Right. Or the person who grabs the chaplain in the moments before their loved one dies and insists on telling them about their recent dental appointment. Yes, this is called displacement, and it's a very common reaction to grief. And also, like, I am here not just for you, but also for your family members, so let's go join them.
Yeah. Whew. So keep your ears out, Patreon supporters, for 4 Weddings and a Funeral.
Yes.
If the AMPTP ever gets their act together to respect the rights of actors to their own image.
Absolutely. And if you're, you know,
yeah.
going to a funeral and you don't know what to do with yourself, have a sandwich. Maybe it'll help.
Have a sandwich. Have a seat.
Sure.
Don't sit in the front if you don't know what to
right.
do. If you do know what to do, sit towards the front. Not in the front row, because that's usually reserved for, like, the immediate loved ones.
Yeah.
Are you curious about how the Twilight Saga is influenced by Mormon theology?
Or why so many vampires are queer-coded?
Have you sat up at night pondering if the documentary Jesus Camp counts as a horror film?
Or have you ever wondered which slasher icon is which member of the Trinity?
Do you ever get into debates about whether the movies Casper, Ghost, and Candyman can be part of the Ghostbusters expanded universe?
Have you watched most of the Nightmare on Elm Street series before the age of 10?
What? Who does that?
Okay, maybe that one's just me. But if you answered yes to any of the other questions, then we've got the podcast for you.
And if you answered yes to Pace's question.
That too. I'm Pace, and I am the super nerdy horror person who's been a horror fan since well before the age when it was appropriate to watch these movies.
And I'm Pastor Emily, and I am the inevitable queer coding somewhere in every horror movie. And we are the hosts of Horror Nerds at Church, a ridiculously queer podcast hosted by 2 non-binary trans nerds.
Each season, we follow a horror franchise and a host of other horror and horror-adjacent movies to talk about how they connect to queerness, religion, and theology.
We feature bona fide scary movies like Halloween, The Witch, Candyman, A Nightmare on Elm Street, and Suspiria.
We also have non-scary movies or low-stake horror movies like Ghostbusters, The Addams Family, Doctor Strange, and Hocus Pocus.
Our upcoming season, we are covering a galaxy far, far away by looking at the Star Wars and Alien franchises from queer, religious, and horror points of view.
So whether you're a lifelong horror master like me,
or a horror Padawan like me,
we have a place for you at Horror Nerds at Church.
Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you catch your podcasts. Our first reading for this episode is Revelation chapter 7, verses 9 through 17. John of Patmos has a vision of the saints and angels gathered around God's throne. So one of the themes in this passage is the idea of, like, the King of the Lambs. Not to be confused with Silence of the Lambs, which is a very, very, very different thing, but it keeps talking about like the lamb seated on the throne. And my sibling had this stuffed animal lambykin, which apparently is actually like a story from a Native American tradition, but had a stuffed animal lambykin. And so now I'm thinking of lambykin or like lamb chop, the puppet with a crown, just like, and a royal decree, just like sitting on the throne.
Nice. I'm mentally crossing lamb chop with Lord Farquaad from Shrek. And yeah, that's pretty much it.
That's fantastic. I love it. And then as we dive into the verses, in verse 9, we read, "After this I looked, and there was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, robed in white, with palm branches in their hands." And I don't know how I never thought of this before, but this was the first time I was like, oh my gosh, this is the circle of life. Simba being held up high and all of the animals coming in the Lion King. It's perfect. Circle.
Awesome.
It's been a while since I sang.
Well, yeah, it's always a good time. And then in verse 11, we read, "And all the angels stood around the throne and around the elders and the four living creatures, and they fell on their faces before the throne and worshipped God." And I realize this is probably not what the author was going for. But does this mean that the four living creatures are the only ones in the scene who are, you know, alive? Like, mortal? Because, like, the angels were not mortal in the first place, and the saints in this picture are, you know, people who have died. And so I'm now thinking about a bit from the book called Team Human by Justine Larbalester, I have no idea if I pronounced her last name right. I apologize in advance. But it was a book about a young woman who is dealing with a group of vampires in her community who are just like living there and, you know, citizens and everything. And her best friend wants to become one, and she's freaking out. And at one point she visits one of the houses where the vampires live, and she realizes it, at one point during that visit, that she is the only living person in the building, and she feels deeply, deeply uncomfortable. And that's kind of the thought that I had here. Like, that feels weird.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say, so then we definitely have to have the humans be those four living creatures so that the Muppets can be the rest.
Oh.
Because technically have
the humans
alive.
Be the four living creatures, and then, but they're also in costume. Just not Muppet costumes. A different genre of costume.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. I just saw a thing about a drag queen who dresses up as cartoon, whose drag is like cartoon. So there's like an Elmo drag, a Belle drag. It's fantastic. I don't know who it is, but that would be fantastic as like a cast. And then in verse 13, we read, "Then one of the elders addressed me, saying, 'Who are these robed in white, and where have they come from?'" This is like one of those asking questions you know the answer to, in the style of like the Commandant in Ember in the Ashes or President Snow to Katniss in Hunger Games. It's like not great. Like, if you know the answer, why are you asking me? You know the answer. Especially for those of us who are neurodivergent. Please don't do that to us.
And then in verse 15, we read, "For this reason, they are before the throne of God and worship him day and night within his temple. And the one who is seated on the throne will shelter them." And this part comes out sounding kind of weirdly like the social contract that supposedly existed between feudal lords and their citizens. Like, one will shelter and the other one will serve him and all that. Only it specifically reminds me of a moment before the second to last mission in the video game Dishonored 2, where one of the characters points out that the possibility of having angry, murderous mobs of your citizens coming after you has kept many rulers from misbehaving too badly toward their subjects. And also, like, that's not how our relationship with God works. Like, this is not the social contract that we have with God.
Yeah, no.
That's not what that's about. God just loves us. That's really all. Yeah.
Yep.
It just sounds a little weird. Mm-hmm. And then our second reading for this episode is from 1 John chapter 3, verses 1 through 3. The author discusses what it means for us to be God's children.
So one of the themes in this passage is the mysterious parentage. We don't know what it is because we're God's children, but we don't really know until later it will be revealed. And it just made me think of Anakin in Star Wars. Because, like, we know who Anakin's mom is, but the, like, mystery of Anakin's conception and the mysterious parentage of Anakin.
His dad is midichlorian. That totally makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that's what I thought of. It's like, Anakin, yeah, okay.
And then in verse 1a, we read, "See what love the Father has given us, that we should be called children of God, and that is what we are." And to be fair, it would be awfully difficult to claim that you love your child if you refuse to acknowledge that they're your, you know, child, right? That seems fair. Acknowledging them is just the start to good parenthood. Like, that's step one. But God has thankfully cleared that low bar. And I'm having more flashbacks to the book The Goblin Emperor by Catherine Addison. Only while that emperor did, technically speaking, acknowledge Maya as his son, it was really only in the legal sense they didn't have a relationship. And so, you know, just barely clearing that low bar is still not very impressive. I'm just saying.
Yeah, agreed. I looked at the second half of that verse that says, the reason the world does not know us is that it did not know God. And that made me think of Darth Vader and Luke and the, like,
jumping down a generation?
Nope. Yeah. Nobody knew Luke because so much had been built around Darth Vader as not, as like the death, the Anakin had died. And so they didn't know Luke's father. And then they did. And if you haven't caught the pattern yet, my next comment will hopefully enlighten you to
yes, you have a theme
pattern here. I'm at for this reading. Yeah.
And then in verse 2, we read, "Beloved, we are God's children now. What we will be has not yet been revealed. What we do know is this: when God is revealed, we will be like him, for we will see him as he is." And is anyone else having Wizard of Oz flashbacks here? You know, who is that man behind the curtain? However, I have to say that I really do genuinely like the idea that we will feel more similar to God when we more fully understand who God is. That does seem lovely, and it's a thought we don't actually have that often.
Yeah, I like it. And then rounding out all three verses where we didn't overlap, yay, even though we picked four verses. In verse 3, we read, "And all who have this hope in God purify themselves just as God is pure." And for this, I was thinking of Star Wars, Clone Wars, which I've been working my way through, and the purification for the younglings when they go on their journey to harvest their kyber crystals. There's like a whole purification thing that happens with them where they have to face like their deepest fears and that sort of a thing in order to find the kyber crystals to then power their lightsabers.
Are any of them afraid of the Sanderson sisters? You know.
Not that I know of. I mean,
it is Hocus Pocus season after all.
It's true. And then our gospel is Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 through 12. Matthew's Beatitudes list the many different blessed types of people of the earth. And one of the themes for this is the idea of blessing in the now, in the present, in the current. And it reminded me of Sacred Incantations, Rituals of Trans Wisdom for Every Season, which is a project by Enfleshed, which we talked about, I think, and it was still in the works when Reverend Anna Bladel came on the podcast. Yeah. But it is now out, and awesome. Yeah, I have seen glimpses of it and still need to order mine, but it's one of those, like, the blessings for the now, the blessings for where we are in this moment.
Yeah. And then in verse 1, we read, "When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him." And I do love these little hints in the scripture that Jesus was an introvert. I know that we can't, like, absolutely say one or the other, but I don't know, like, or maybe it's just that it takes longer than slightly over 30 years to get used to being around other people as a person instead of as God. Like, I don't know how that works either, but I love the humanness of Jesus just nope octopusing out of social situations every so often. Like, that is one meme I think he would love.
I have never heard it called nope octopus.
You've seen the nope octopus meme, though, right? The octopus that is just moving along the ocean floor very quickly, and there's nope, 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 nope across the bottom.
No.
Oh, I will have to find that for you. It's very cute. But that's what I'm thinking of when I think of Jesus just going zoop right up the mountain. I'm not going toward the people. Nope. The disciples can follow. That's fine.
Yeah. And which is interesting because then in verse 2, Jesus began to speak and taught them, presumably the disciples, saying, and then it goes into the Beatitudes. And, like, he sees the crowd. The crowd presumably sees him. So I imagine Jesus then sits down and is talking to his disciples, and then people, like, gather and more people are coming to overhear.
Yeah, possibly.
What Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount. And it reminded me of the episode of Gilmore Girls when Rory and Lorelai go visit Harvard on a whim when Lorelai is breaking off her engagement, one of her engagements. Yeah. And they go to, like, look at Harvard just on their own, not an official tour or anything. And Rory sneaks into one of the classes and is, like, sitting in the class and, like, gets to, like, participate and say a thing and then leaves. But it's this, like, overhearing when it might not be technically intended for you, but the, like, wisdom and stuff. Yeah. I think there is a lot that happened in the pandemic, too, of, like, schools being like, here, have access to our ASL class or this class or that. And then in verse 4, we read, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. And I was thinking about this and thinking about miscarriages and the ways that those can be really hard. And there's obviously mourning, but also the, like, part of this is comfort for those who mourn happens in community. And so thinking about, like, the ways that people who have had miscarriages or stillbirths maybe tell everybody at the beginning of the first pregnancy and then don't tell many people when they get pregnant after that until much later. And what ends up happening is if they do have another miscarriage, there's more isolation because people don't know.
Yeah.
And so this is just my plug that you don't have to tell everybody, but tell the people who are important to you because they will be the people who support you if it happens again.
Yeah.
And you're not jinxing yourself. You're not jinxing anybody. When I would do the blessings at the hospital, I would, like, the certificate, we write down who's present. And I would tell the couple, the families, this is who is here to show up, to support you, who knows and acknowledges what is going on. And by being present for this, you all are committing to supporting them in their grief and in their love of this child. So.
And then in verse 11, we read, blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. And I was reminded recently that, you know, the last part of this verse does actually exist, like those last three words, on my account. Like, this is not just about people treating you like crap. This is about God blessing you when you are treated like crap on God's behalf, or when you're acting for Jesus, or when you're acting like Jesus. Like, random people just...
I also, like, the on my account, I think of people who are treated like this by Christians.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is, like, a different...
Sure. But, like, random people just being rude to you for no apparent reason or for other reasons that have nothing to do with, you know, faith or anything, that's not actually about this, and that just still sucks. But, like, ask Shrek. Shrek was both surrounded by people who were constantly rude to him and also was pretty rude to other people. It had nothing to do with Jesus at the start, like, and then he goes through the movie and he finds some self-acceptance, and that's great. But, like, not all rudeness relates back to this verse.
Yeah.
And now for what will almost certainly be our most memorialized segment. Let's make a Muppets musical.
In my head I was like, our least deadly segment.
I suppose. Yeah. I think we did infect some Muppets with leprosy once, but that was anyway.
That's true.
So
that's
Emily, true. Did you that's have fair. Any thoughts about Muppets for this episode?
Well, now you've okay, the combination of your wondering who's actually alive in Revelation and my, like, Lion King view. Yeah, I want that to be the casting. I want Revelation to be gathering all these different, like, all the different Muppets. Like, from the end of the Muppets show to the new baby Muppets that exist to Sesame Street, Avenue Q, everywhere.
Yeah.
I want them all to gather for Revelation.
Absolutely. I was also kind of thinking about something vaguely related to that for the gospel reading, which is that I think the various types of blessed people should be illustrated by Muppets. because I think a Muppet illustrating those who mourn, those who are meek, those who are peacemakers. Fozzie Bear strikes me as a really good peacemaker, just because everyone would be focused on laughing at his jokes rather than doing anything else. Sometimes distraction is the best policy. And all the others, I think they could be illustrated very well by Muppets. And maybe it's, you know, so I suppose I'm assuming that Jesus would be the human here, and then like the disciples are Muppets, and then also there are additional Muppets around them who are illustrating the different blessed people. Or maybe each of the individual disciples are also the blessed people. I don't know. I don't know that anyone's ever brought up that option before to me. Because I'm used to thinking of the different types of blessed people are the folks of the world and of the church and like the folks who have died. Like, you know, there's all that variety within them. But also, like, I suppose Jesus might have been looking at his disciples and saying, oh, yes, you are meek, you are mourning, you are...
Yeah, you blessed are the poor in spirit. You. Especially the Luke version, I think, because it's blessed are you when.
Yes, but I would expect less so with the Luke version because that's the one with the woes. And, like, I would hope he wouldn't be pointing at his disciple and saying, woe to you. Right?
That's kind of
a lot. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks for joining us. Theme music was by Rachel Meyer Lachlan, and Muppets music was by Brenda Boss. Catch us next time when we'll discuss nerdery connections to the scripture readings for the 23rd Sunday after Pentecost with special guest Mother Jo Kershaw. This podcast has been produced by us, Emily Ewing and Kay Roloff. For more fun, check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and now Blue Sky at Nerds at Church, or contact us at nerdsatchurch@gmail.com.
Also, if you like what you've heard, rate us or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Facebook, or wherever you catch your podcasts. If you want access to our uncut guest episodes and interviews, live Q&As, and more, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nerdsatchurch. It's cheaper than just about anything you'll get from a funeral home.
Or just about any aspect of a funeral at all. Yeah. Also, let us know on Blue Sky, Facebook, or Twitter who you would cast for Let's Make a Muppets Musical for this episode.
As the ancient Christians said,
Pax vobiscum.